You might be looking at your outline with a little bit of fear and trepidation. Certainly, when you compare the outline from tonight and from this morning, you can see quite a difference in terms of content. Initially, I thought to myself that the first 2 points in particular were somewhat foundational, notes that had been sounded before, that I could maybe simply just hit a couple of those notes quickly and get to the Hebrews 4 passage in point number 3 that really brings things somewhat into greater clarity for us. But then as I reviewed and prayed and thought and reflected upon points number 1 and points number 2, I thought they are foundational, and they are, I hope, familiar to you. But there have been so many occasions in my own experience when examining foundations, I've discovered fresh insight. And I've seen connections that are very helpful, even though I'm looking at a subject or looking at a text that I've looked at hundreds of times. So my hope tonight is to preach from points number 1 and 2, and then we'll leave points 3 and 4 for next Lord's Day. Referring to that experience of looking at familiar texts or familiar truth, and then having what is called a eureka moment, a moment of discovery, a moment where things seem to come into alignment in a fresh way, even though you have looked at the text hundreds of times before. Suddenly, it's as though a light goes on, and you discover that there are connections here, that there are dimensions of truth that open up before you, like realizing the light just comes on in the room, and the room that you're in is much bigger than what you thought it was. You're sitting under a little reading lamp in the dark, and then all of these lights come on in the ceiling, and you realize, I'm in a big room. And not only that, but this room is joined to a corridor that connects to yet other rooms, and the house that I'm living in is much more wonderful and magnificent than I ever realized. Maybe I should get off my chair and walk around a little bit and see what the Lord has built for us in our theological homes, if you will. A couple of these eureka moments I refer to by way of introduction, and they're relevant to the subject at hand when we consider the matter of heaven as our eternal Sabbath rest. 83 and 84, I was auditing classes at Trinity Ministerial Academy at Montville, and I was sitting in on a class on the doctrine of man, and Pastor Greg Nichols was teaching the class, and he said 3 words one day in class that just electrified me. Image is ethics. And that little statement just was an explosive enlightenment of truth. It was a shift in the foundational structures of my understanding of man as made in the image of God, and the fact that it's not simply that we are obligated to obey ethical norms or ethical laws, but that we are in our very beings ethical creatures, that we are in fact made very good, and that the nature of what we are and who we are as image of God is not morally neutral. It is part of the good creation of God, and that ethics is rooted more in the nature of our being than simply principles and abstract ethical concepts that kind of hover over us. And that's how we often think of ethics. We learned our thinking often in Greek culture, a Greek Western way of thinking, Aristotelian values. We want to be good, we want to be generous, we want to be kind, and we have these these norms that sort of hang over us as obligations to which we need to aspire. But actually, ethics is far more profound. It has to do with who we are as the image of God. And therefore, there's obligations that come to us simply by being human. And that has to do with the God that we image. And so it's much more a profound way of looking at our identity and who we are as image of God and the essential goodness of God's original created order. And then another eureka moment came back in 2010. I was actually preparing to write a paper on the Sabbath, and I was rereading a book that I had read years ago by a man named Gerhardus Voss. Gerhardus Voss is one of the original professors at Princeton University back in the 20s when that university was a solid, reformed voice on the landscape of theology. And I was reading his book, Biblical Theology of the Old and the New Testaments. And on page 140, all right, so get ready, here it comes. The sentence reads, "The eschatological is an older strand in Revelation than the soteric." I'm sure maybe you didn't feel the voltage of that, but that was an electrifying statement to me because I had always been taught that eschatology had to do with salvation. The word soteric is an adjective of salvation or soteriology. And what Voss was commenting on is the fact that before God outlines the agenda for salvation in Genesis 3:15, that most foundational text where the Lord speaking to the serpent announces the two seeds and the ultimate victory of the seed of the woman over the seed of the serpent by the crushing of the head of the serpent by the heel of the seed of the woman, before that announcement of redemption is given to man, before God launches his program of salvation, he had already given to Adam an eschatology. He had already given to Adam a doctrine of last things. He had already given to Adam something that pointed Adam to the age to come, pointed Adam to what we now know to be resurrection hope and resurrection life. And that preceded the inauguration of the program of salvation. And what Voss is pointing to is the fact that after God completed the work of creation, he entered into his Sabbath rest. And because man is image of God, and because image is ethics, and that it is good and right for man to image God, therefore to be like God, that he might be with God, because of that truth, man would have every expectation, Adam in particular, had every expectation that upon the completion of his work, as God completed God's work, Adam also would enter into God's Sabbath rest. He had that hope. He had that eschatology. He had that understanding of how time and history was to unfold and that it would then have a goal and a terminating point that would transition him into an eschatological fulfillment, into the hope of the age to come, into whatever that is, that the God he is made to be like, the God he is made to be with, whatever he just did there in entering into his Sabbath rest, that's my destiny. But meanwhile, I've been given a work to do. As God was given a work to do, if you will, as God assumed the work to do. And that structure then becomes the structure of time and the structure of history. And it's a structure in which we still presently live. And I just got done telling you everything I basically want to say. Because if you can carry with you that to this evening, then you've been able to touch base with these foundational truths. And then to take that and to reflect further upon where we now presently are in that abiding structure of time and history and ethics and image bearing and the eschatological hope of the age to come. So some of this might be familiar to you, but perhaps I might say something in a way that will grip you, the way Pastor Nichols did. Images, ethics. And I sat there thinking, and this whole door just opened up. I don't know what he said after that, but I can remember that just was like an explosive opening of things that I had thought about, things I had reflected about, and it seemed to come together in a fresh and vital way that has since served me very helpfully since that time. Well, let's consider point number one in our evidently part one series study here on heaven as our Sabbath rest. And the first is that we were made to live with God in Sabbath blessings. Now, again, as I've already expressed, the truth, the phrase images ethics is profound because it defines ethics not simply as a code, as a concept, as norms and values, as it were, disconnected from us, but we are essentially moral creatures. We are made with a moral identity. So our morality is not only found in the things that we do, but is essential to our very being. It's essential to what we are. And what are we? Well, we're finite creatures. We're creatures of time. And that's all part and parcel of what God originally created and announced to be very good. And so the fact that we are finite creatures living in the chronological sequence of time, that's a good thing. And that's essentially good as part of God's original creation. If you go back to Genesis 1 and verse 31, we have the culmination of a sequence of seven judgments that God has now made upon His creation through the course of the creation week. Seven times He has looked upon the unfolding of this work and saw that it was good. And then in verse 31, God saw all that He made, and behold, it was very good. There was evening and there was morning the sixth day. So we're to understand here that this movement through the days of creation and the days being marked by this repeated phrase, there was evening and there was morning, and then numbering the sequence of days, we are to understand that this unfolding of divine activity through the course of time is something God says is very good. God says that's very good. And His own behavior as the Creator sets the norm and the standard for His image bearer's behavior. He doesn't come and tell Adam, work. He doesn't give him a command. But He places him in the garden with an assumed purpose that he is going to labor and he's going to work because he is imaging his Creator Father. And likewise, there would be the assumption that the completion of his work would also issue into the goodness of the prospect of God's Sabbath rest. So the Bible would have us understand that time is linear, that time is sequential, and that time moves forward toward a goal. And that's a biblical view of history. Up until the present time, that's been the predominant understanding of history. But now that we are more inclined to open up our universities and to open up ourselves to unbiblical concepts and unbiblical worldviews, there are many, even in our own culture in our day, who do not see time as being linear, sequential, and moving toward a particular goal. but rather they see time as chaotic, as happenstance, perhaps as circular, spiraling, spinning. And as a result, they would say, in essence, history has no meaning. We've never been anywhere. We're not going anywhere. And what we have right now is just a passing, fleeting moment of insignificance. Have you ever heard anybody express that kind of thing? Have you ever read anything that expresses that kind of thing? That's a scientific view of time in many areas. It's a pagan view of time. Carl Sagan had that view of time. There's no purpose to it. There's no eschatology to it. There's no ultimate meaning to it. And that's a view that has gained an awful lot of traction as the thinking, universities, publishers, so forth and so on, move away from a biblical view of time and creation and a biblical view of God. Now, in chapter 2, we're introduced to the Sabbath. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed and all their hosts. By the seventh day, God completed his work by which he had done. God completed his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made. Now, the morality of the good, in verse 31 of chapter 1, that which is morally good, he saw it as very good. Now we're introduced to even more elevated terms. And we're introduced to the terms of blessed. And we're introduced to the term sanctified. Something is going on here that elevates us, if you will, up and beyond the ordinary goodness of God's work of creation. And part of that, as associating this seventh day, is associating with God's words and with God's person, God himself. Now, I say that it's associated with God's words because God blessed the day. And if you look at chapter 1, verse 28, you see what is involved when God does this thing called blessing. God blessed them, and God said to them. So God blessing this day informs us that although we don't have a record of the words, there are words that God has associated with this particular period of time, words that were associated with the seventh day, words that were communicated, we assume, to the creature who was made to commune with God through words. And that, of course, was Adam and his wife Isha, or eventually Eve. And then you have this statement that God sanctified the day. And that's one of those stunning statements, again, because when you sit down and think about what you normally conceive when someone says that this is sanctified, you usually think, well, it has been rescued from sin. It's part of that which God does in salvation. And that we're sanctified after we have been justified. And that is after we have repented and believed, which is after we've been regenerated, which is after the gospel has come to us and the Spirit has made the Word living and alive. So by the time you get to the word sanctification, it's embedded in the context of salvation. But here we meet with the word at a point of time when there is no sin, when there's no death, and there's no curse. And all there is the landscape of very goodness. And yet here is something that God says he blesses and he sanctifies it. Now, I hope that you see, as we study a little bit further tonight, that what God does when He sanctifies something is He takes it and associates it in particular with His own person and with His own presence. And so I submit to you that this is an indication of God associating this particular time with Himself, and that this is holy time. And it's not separated here so much from sin, but it's separated from this age order of creation time. It's eschatological time, if you will. It's a time that Adam had put before him in the regular weekly cycle of the days, so that the seventh day was both a goal to which he worked and also a promise of that which lay before him, because in his unique experience, the experience of his first day would have been the seventh day. He was created on the sixth, so his first full day, his first day would have been the seventh. But that's another point of contemplation that brings you to think about Adam's perspective on the future. But again, with this concept of image is ethics, and man is made to image and reflect God and to be like God, and isn't it intriguing? That's exactly the temptation that Satan puts before the couple. Aren't you supposed to be like God? Isn't that a good thing? Isn't it good to be like God? That's what you're made for, right? The same sort of strategy he does with our Lord in the wilderness temptations. Since you're the Son of God, aren't you the Son of God? Isn't it a good thing to be the Son of God? Well, aren't you supposed to have all the kingdoms? And isn't God your protector and your father? Can't you just turn this stone into bread? Wouldn't that be a good thing? After all, aren't you the Son of God? Well, he's doing the same thing here. And so he's acting upon that which is good and which is true, but he's doing it in order to have the couple strive to be like God, but doing so in a way that's disobedient, in a way that preempts God's giving of them the blessings that are held before them in the Sabbath day. So man was made to be like God and to image God through the course of time. That's why it took God so long to create the world, because he was establishing the pattern by which his image would be glorified in a created order, so that the finite creature would image him in the same way, doing and acting and being like him, because image is ethics. So God completed his work in verse 2, and then he rested. The Hebrew verb is Sabbath. So what does that obligate upon man? Well, he's to do the same thing. And he's to expect the same results. That he's to do the work assigned to him, complete it, and then he will, like God, be with God, and be like God, and enter into God's Sabbath rest. So, what was that work that he was assigned to do? Well, we've called it the dominion mandate in Genesis 1, 20, 26 to 28, and we've identified these creation ordinances, and we call them ordinances because we recognize them as moral obligations, but we don't quite call them laws or commandments because they weren't articulated as laws or commandments. They were rather the structure of morality that came out of the very nature of man's being. And what am I referring to? I'm referring to him being made image of God, male and female, which necessitates the union of the man and the woman for the purpose of procreation, and that becomes part of his creation ordinances. And I'm also talking about the fact that he was put into the garden to dance. He was put in the garden to play. He was put in the garden to work. And that's not part of the curse. We experience the thorns and the thistles with our work. And then we extrapolate the whole thing and say, well, work itself is a pain. work itself is a curse. That's not true. The thorns and the thistles are the curse. The work is good because we are imaging God. And along with the work, he would then have the prospect of entering into God's Sabbath rest. And so there's where theologians come up with the language of the covenant of works, or the arrangement or the relationship of works, so that when Adam completed his works, he would then enter into God's rest. He would complete his mandate as God completed the creation work. He would be like God, except he would display the glory of God through the milieu of time, and he would do so in the theater of created space. So the original scheme was that Adam would complete the mandate God had given to him, and through his holy industry, through his good work, he would enlarge the garden temple, and we've looked at these motifs in our series on heaven already, and that enlargement of the boundary of the temple as more and more workers were assigned that task, as the couple would be fruitful and multiply, and the image of God would enlarge numerically, and the glory of God would expand spatially as his garden temple would grow and grow to the place where the entire world would be brought under the glorious dominion of the image of God as a dwelling place of God with his creature Son. And I believe that God gave the couple foretastes of that on the seventh day, and that they had a sufficient experience of that prior to the fall itself, so that the goal of time, the goal of history, was this prospect of being with God, being like God, then being with God in this future hope of entering God's Sabbath rest. And notice, it's God's Sabbath rest. That's important as we would trace this theme through the Scriptures. It's God's rest into which man aspires to hope after the completion of his work. So the goal of life with God is under this prospect of entering God's Sabbath rest. That's better than any condo on the golf course, on the Gulf Coast. The entering into God's Sabbath rest. Talk about explosive. All things are yours. And the glory of creaturely imaging of God in a place where God has blessed it and God has sanctified it. And all of that would have certainly whet Adam's appetite and held that hope before him. So as I've already said, this statement in Voss's book, the eschatological is an older strand in Revelation than the soteric. Before the fall, Adam had this hope. Before the announcement of salvation in Genesis 3:15, Adam already had God's Sabbath rest as the prospect of his eschatological hope that he would complete his work through the course of time and then enter into this sanctified time, this time that was elevated beyond the regular goodness of the 6 days and elevated into this period of time that was marked out as something radically different. Voss says, again, the so-called covenant of works was nothing but an embodiment of the Sabbath principle. Again, reflecting upon that, saying Adam's stewardship of the covenant of works, his responsibility in those creation ordinances, was an embodiment, an outworking of the Sabbath principle. And the Sabbath principle is inherent in the work of God in creation. It's the end point to which all things come. It's the completion. It's the goal. It's the purpose. It gives the meaning. Why are you working today, Adam? It's only Wednesday. Because I'm getting that much closer to the completion of my task. For what purpose? Because when I'm finished, I'm going to enter into God's Sabbath rest. And that gives meaning to my work. That gives purpose to my labor. That gives dignity to me as an image bearer. And I'm not just doing that because God has given me some abstract command of virtue, of some sort of Protestant work ethic that holds, it's held over my head as some principle or some philosophical concept. That's what I'm made to do. And that's where I find my meaning and my purpose and my significance. And that's where I find my happiness and my joy, because I am reflecting and imaging God and doing what He's destined me to do and purposed for me to do. And my life now has significance. And my life now has meaning. And all of that was given to Adam before the fall. The covenant of works is nothing but the embodiment of the Sabbath principle. It's intriguing, even in the literature, that Moses seems to use, if you will, otherworldly signals in the way in which he describes God's Sabbath rest. All of the 6 days prior were demarcated by the repeated phrase, and there was evening and there was morning. You find that in verse 5, verse 8, verse 13, 19, 23, and 31, marking the 6 previous creation days. And by the time you get to the seventh, where you would read, and by the seventh day, God completed the work that He had done, and you're expecting to read, and there was evening and there was morning the seventh day. But that phrase does not show up. And I think that's not just a literary device. That's significant. The absence of that repeated phrase that marks and delineates the first 6 days indicates there's something about the seventh day in the way in which it's to be understood as a period of time. The absence of the evening and the morning language presents us with the seventh day as a period of unbounded time, as a period of time that is unending. And it's unlike the other 6 days. It stands, if you will, like a doorway that opens up into eternity. Even though we experience it through the weekly cycle, it is a significant thing because it stands not only as the end point to which history is driving, but it also stands as the beginning point of whatever this Sabbath rest is that God has already entered into and which He holds before His human image bearer and says, "Son, be like me and come be with me. And we'll live together in this glorious prospect of God's Sabbath rest." So, secondly, we are saved to live with God in Sabbath rest. We have been made, we've been created for this purpose, and then, of course, we are saved. And here's where we get a little bit more comfortable with these concepts, because we are now taught, as we read, especially through our Old Testaments, and that's as far as I want to get us in the moments remaining, is that God taught His Old Covenant people that their greatest blessing, their greatest prospect, their greatest aspiration and hope is to be a people that would live with Him, enjoying His Sabbath blessings. And so the concept of Sabbath was combined with the prospect of the promised land. And so you have space, the land, sanctified by the presence of God who dwelt with His people in His house, in His temple, and who dwelt with them to sanctify them in this sanctified space. Again, hearkening back to the garden itself. And when you read the prospect of the promised land, it looks almost like the Israelites are anticipating entering this place that is almost Edenic, flowing with milk and honey and this kind of language. It's idyllic in the prospect of going to this land. Why? Because it is the place, it is the space that is holy because of God's presence there. And then God not only gives them holy space, but he gives them holy time as well. So if you look at Exodus chapter 20, and here we come to the giving of the Ten Commandments, and it's very instructive. The record of the giving of the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20, and the record of the giving of the Ten Commandments again, the Deuteronomy, the second giving of the law, in Deuteronomy chapter 5. But let's look at Exodus chapter 20, particularly looking at the rationale for the Sabbath. In the fourth commandment, we read in verse 8, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male or female servant or your cattle or your sojourner who stays with you." Well, why? What's the rationale? How come? Verse 11, "For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy." The Lord rested. He blessed it. Obviously, you're supposed to think about Genesis chapter 2, verses 2 and 3. Those are the same vocabulary words. And the question then is asked, well, so what? So that's what the Lord did. Okay. Don't you see the undergirding assumption? Because the Lord did this, you're to do this. Because this is how you live with the Lord. This is how you image Him. This is how you bear His name. This is how you receive the blessings of being His people. So then over in Deuteronomy chapter 5, now we come to the second giving of the law. And if you read the giving of the law in Deuteronomy chapter 5, you'll find that it's the same law that was given at Sinai in Exodus chapter 20, except for the rationale that is recorded for the reason of the fourth commandment of the Sabbath day. In verse 13, 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, or your male servant or female servant, or your ox or your donkey or any of your cattle or your sojourner who stays with you, so that your male servant and your female servant may rest as well as you. And now this connection of the servant resting issues into verse 15. "You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out of there by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore the Lord your God commanded you to observe the Sabbath day." Now the rationale is not creation, but now the rationale is salvation. The rationale is redemption. The rationale now is because of what God has done for us in the Exodus. So what is the very essence of Sabbath blessing? What is the very, very core of this time that God gives to His people, a time that is blessed with peculiar words of blessing, and that is sanctified with proximity and association with the very person of the living God? Well, it's that living character. This blessing of Sabbath is life. The blessing of Sabbath is life. In Adam, it was an elevated life that was brought into a more glorious dimension of imaging God in a more glorious manifestation of life lived with God. And then in the Old Covenant, and as we'll see in the New and on into the age to come as we progress through our study, that the essence of blessing, the essence of Sabbath blessing is life lived with God. Life lived with God. Being with Him, being like Him, and living with Him. And all of that is language that points us to the age to come, the prospect of entering God's Sabbath rest. So when you look back at Exodus chapter 31, we learn that in the Old Covenant there is a sign that was associated with that covenant arrangement. There was the Noahic covenant, and the sign was the rainbow. There was the Abrahamic covenant, and the sign was circumcision. Well, in Exodus 31, we learn in verse 13 and following that the sign associated with the Mosaic Old Covenant theocracy was, in fact, the blessing of the Sabbath. As for you, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, you shall surely observe, notice, my Sabbaths. My Sabbaths. For this is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you. Therefore, you are to observe the Sabbath, for it is holy to you. Everyone who profanes it shall utterly be put to death, for whoever does any work on it, that person shall be cut off from among his people. For 6 days work may be done, but on the seventh day there is a Sabbath of complete rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day shall surely be put to death. So the sons of Israel shall observe the Sabbath to celebrate the Sabbath throughout the generations as a perpetual covenant. It is a sign between me and the sons of Israel forever. Why? For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, but on the seventh day he ceased from labor and was refreshed. What's God doing? He says, I'm giving to you a foretaste of what I have always intended for you, that you would enter into my Sabbath. That you would enter into my Sabbath rest. And it's this is the sign. This is the signal blessing of the people of God under the old covenant arrangement, that they were not given to the curse of the thorns and the thistles that overcame all of the other pagan cultures round about them. And if you look at them, you'll find oftentimes, cultures themselves can be seen with patterns of laziness and incompetence in their work ethic. That's dismal. And then other times, there are cultures that are workaholics, and they can't take a break, and they can't rest. And God comes to His people and says, "You're going to be a different people. I want you to do your work, but I want you to be refreshed in My presence." And enjoy my Sabbath. And so that becomes something that the Israelites are learned to associate. They learn to associate the Sabbath as something that God gives them. And it's His possession. It's His sharing with them of Himself in holy time. And He does that in conjunction with their dwelling upon the land, so that when they are cast out from the land, it's because they haven't observed the Sabbaths correctly. Because the time and the space. Are you surprised that God deals with you in time and space? We're creatures of dust and chronological sequence. And our salvation comes to us in time and space. So, I've listed for you on your outline the various places in Leviticus where God speaks to His people about the prospect of them enjoying His Sabbaths, my Sabbaths, He talks. He talks about in Exodus and Leviticus, again, other citations there, where you learn of the Sabbath of the Lord and a Sabbath to the Lord. And as we'll learn as we continue our study, that this was the essential blessing that God gave to Adam right from the very, very beginning. And God hasn't changed. God hasn't changed His plan. God hasn't changed His purpose. God hasn't changed the way in which He has structured time and history. We still live in this same structure. We learn in Hebrews 9:27 that it is appointed unto man once to die and then comes judgment. And that this is, in fact, the structure of time and history. This is how we live in this created order. Is it fallen? Yes. Does it have the markings of the curse? Yes. Does the God of this age run rampant, as we learned in the nursing home this afternoon, blinding the eyes of men and unbelievers to the glory of God revealed in the face of Christ? Is Satan rampant? Yes. But has the fundamental structure of God's created order been altered? No. Has the fundamental structure of time and history and eschatology been changed? No. We all still live in this fundamental structure that has been established through creation of the 6 days of God doing His work, bookended by the morning and evening demarcation of chronological, finite, this age time that enters into the seventh day blessing of God's Sabbath day that opens up into unbounded time. And we still live in that structure. And as we'll learn, God willing, next week, Jesus Christ lived in that structure, and Jesus Christ has accomplished the work and has gone before us into that Sabbath rest. And now we too are called, likewise, to run our race, complete our work, that we might also enter into that Sabbath rest. And that Sabbath rest, as it's described in Revelation 14:13, comes to us. Let's look there and we'll conclude with that. In Revelation 14:13, this rest comes to us after we have done our work. Does that mean we earn salvation by work? No. It means that we live in the world that God has created for us. That we, in this present time, as creatures of this original created order, still deal with the issues called space and time. And so we are given this structure in which we live out, our lives. And so we read in Revelation 14:13, I looked and behold a white cloud, wrong verse. And I heard a voice from heaven saying, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, so that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow with them. So now is the time for work. Now is the time for labor. We're given the blessings and the foretastes and the refreshments of God's presence with us as we assemble and as He comes and refreshes us with the vitality and the movement of His Spirit and the ministry of His Word and the refreshment of each other's love and grace and encouragements of edification, and that gives us a foretaste so that we press on and we continue to run our race and we continue to complete our course through the course of time in the place of God's appointment, because we are His image bearers and image is ethics. And we've been made to live like Him, to be like Him, to live with Him. And He holds before us this most wonderful, wonderful, wonderful prospect. Come and enter into my Sabbath rest. May God encourage us and instruct us as we consider how to view heaven as our Sabbath rest. Amen.